Golden Village. Today's date is September 10th, 2002. Today's session is God perfect? Who do you think God is and why does it matter? Presented by Gene Diller Murphy. Number MUJD 2002-02. Let's listen in.
And what I am talking about this week comes from my dissertation, which I wrote, completed in 2000, and let's not talk about how long it took. Anybody who was here last time have any questions or issues you want to raise from last time? Is that done around here? Is that in the same format? Okay. Just briefly, last time we talked about sort of what I think of as the forest of possible notions of God. And this time what we're doing is kind of going into two particular trees in that forest. One of them being perfect being theology and the other one being relational theology. And if, for those of you who were here last time, we had a couple of columns up here on the board which pretty much match the two columns you can see on the handout. On the first page, under A, where it says two theologies. Perfect being theology is, in short, the view that what it takes to be God, or what it means to be God, or the essence of divinity, is perfection. And that is, as we'll see, a really popular view now and has been for a really long time. And that was kind of apparent last session when we noticed that people were throwing out some of those adjectives like the next column over. So what I just talked about was number one. And number two, people were throwing out adjectives which I call the omnis and the ends, omnipotence, omniscience. Omnipotence meaning all-powerful, omniscience, all-knowing, omnibenevolence, all-loving, omnipresence, all-present, immutability, not even able to change, impassibility, not affected by anything, impeccability. Isn't that a fun one to say? Impeccability. Which kind of means what it sounds like. Not able to sin, so there's sort of no error in making. Like that's sort of like you would think with someone who's really good at etiquette, that they have impeccable manners. Like that, except it's all about morality, not just manners. Incorporeality, as you guys all know, doesn't have a body. Necessity, meaning had to exist, could not have failed to exist. And that's a fascinating category of things, because we could all have failed to exist, at least philosophers think so. You could imagine a world where you weren't. You can imagine a world where this chair wasn't there and instead there was a zebra. Or, well, you can imagine that. But necessity is sort of like you can't imagine a world where there isn't this being. Timelessness. That one has a super long history, but the main thing people say about it is that you're sort of outside of time. You don't have any understanding of what time is. You're not affected by time in any way. Well, gosh, you might have to have understanding if you're on mission. But you're not going to have it in the sense of having experienced it. And then simplicity is another kind of, I think, a tough one to understand. But the idea is there are no parts in you, and usually what's, this is kind of an old favorite for the Greeks, but the reason people want to have no parts, think that's perfect, is because then you can't cut them up into little bits and make them disappear. So there's something about stability and sort of necessity which kind of forces this hand of simplicity. Okay, so all those complicated words that I just said are on the traditional view what it takes to be perfect, in the sense at issue in perfect being theology, the first view that we're going to be looking at today about who God is. So the idea is sort of the relationship between column one and column two is sort of like you got to have what's in column two if you want to end up having the perfection in column one. What's a good, is this clear? Do I need to elucidate that? Or any questions about that? Okay. Do you find that familiar to you? Does that sound?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. So that's the first view. And I guess I just kind of want to emphasize right now that when I'm talking about perfection from here on out, what I mean is that stuff in column two. Now, I take it that there are lots of other interesting notions of perfection out there. And I've been kind of wondering whether we should talk about that at some point. But I've also been kind of feeling like if we did that right now, we probably wouldn't do a lot of other stuff that we're going to do. So I think, is that something you guys would like to talk about at some point, though? Notions of perfection?
No.
No.
Okay, great. good. Okay, so that makes my job easier.
You may want to pick
I may just force that upon you.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So the second view is relational theology. And in the advertisement, I said this is a recently developed alternative, and the truth is that I recently developed it. so, and it, nobody knows about it. So, except now you guys will. So that's a good thing. And I'm trying to publish about it. So, just think of it as a diamond in the rough, and you're going to help me shine it up. What do you do?
Polish it.
Polish it.
Will you be burned at the stake when the church is
closed? If so, we never knew you.
That's another thing I should say, is that I did actually lose a job over the fact that somebody thought I was a heretic for believing this.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't, it saddened me and angered me, I guess, at the same time. But I don't mean to step on anybody's toes, but then I was thinking if I do, just talk to me about it. I guess that would be really interesting if you think that what I'm saying is so wrong, that I'm heretical. I'd like to know that, and I'd like to know why. And I'd like it that that didn't mean that we couldn't talk to each other anymore, which is sort of how it felt. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, I was running up and down the stairs. Could you summarize real quick again the point that you were fired over?
When they understood my view, they...
what was that view again?
The view is relational theology.
Okay.
The view that I'm going to try to elucidate today, the whole theology that I'm thinking is a better alternative.
Relational.
Yeah. Than perfect being theology.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I wasn't really fired, I just never got hired.
Oh.
But by the end, I didn't want to work there anymore. Okay. So in other words, I'm totally open to talking about that. Okay. So now, so the essence of perfect being theology is that what it takes to be God is to be perfect in the sense of having the omnis and the ends. And on my view, on relational theology, what it takes to be God is not that, but rather doing the divine jobs. Now, it sounds kind of circular. You're like, you get to use the word divine and explaining who God is. Something sounds fishy here. Okay? But that's only sounding fishy because that's my shorthand for flip over the page. It's a terribly complicated chart.
Do you have more of those things?
I don't. So okay. If you guys could share with people who don't have them, that would be great. Sorry. Thanks.
Thanks.
Now, first of all, I want to just say that the important part of this chart is all the little non-folded words. And the essence of my view is that what it takes to be God is to do a central number of those things that are described there, or not described, but identified there. So what it takes to be God is to be a being who can cause the stuff that you see in that first column under causal relations. So you have to cause the existence of the universe. You have to cause people to have what's called a numinous experience, which is not everybody has to have that, but there are people, mystics, who have a certain kind of experience that they call numinous experience, which we can talk about more if you want to. But it's a form of religious experience that's really deep and where you feel identified with, in some cases, all of nature, in other cases, God, depending on the kind of mystic that you're talking to. So, in any case, at least, well, gosh, I should say, you guys, before I get all specific here, the idea here is that, the overarching idea is that when you read, let's say you have a really complicated scientific theory, sorry, I have a baby, so when babies cry, I look up. You know, it's not my baby, or is it?
No, it's not yours.
So when you have a complicated scientific theory, say about a proton, okay, and you don't know what the heck a proton is, one way of trying to understand it is to look at what the theory says a proton does. So a proton is, scientists might be able to correct me here, but a proton is the kind of thing that makes a certain sort of path through a cloud chamber and affects other instruments in other ways. And so one way of understanding what it is by sort of enumerating the things the theory says about it. And that view is a view in philosophy of science, which one day I was in a philosophy of science class, inspired me to think about God this way. Because I thought, you know, you could look at the text of the tradition as a theory about something we're not super clear about. And you could read who God is as the being who does all the sorts of things that those texts describe God as doing. So in order to pick out this complicated thing, let's just look at what the texts say it does. Questions about that sort of strategy? That inspiration? Because I guess I take it that God is way more complicated than a proton. And so I guess I just thought that that was kind of a nice way of talking about something you didn't understand very well, but that you could see the effects of, or you thought you could see the effects of. And so what I did was spend about 6 months kind of looking at some of the basic texts of the tradition, like the Bible. This is kind of tough because people disagree over what the sort of authoritative texts are, those which you might want to turn to as sources that would help you identify God in a way that people who believed in this tradition would say, yeah, those are ones that I would turn to if I wanted to ground my notion. So what I ended up doing was sort of making an executive decision that the ones that were important were the Bible, the creeds. You can see, did I mention this? If you look at footnote one, I looked at some of the major theologians, Augustine, Anselm, Aquinas, Maimonides, who's a Jewish theologian. The first three are Christian. And then I looked at some of the mystics. And the effort was to try to read these texts. Interestingly, I should mention, some of these guys that I just talked about are perfect being theologians themselves. But what I did was to look at their texts with a different eye. I didn't want to read them to see how they sort of described God straight out, because they were going to say, God is omnipotent, God is omniscient. I wanted to read it to figure out what they would say God could do, or what they expected of God. What kind of attitude they felt they could have toward God. And then use that to build this little list of relations. So that's how I did it. Is this clear? Is this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think so.
Okay, well, so tell me a question.
No, it's clear.
Yeah?
It's almost as limited by our own capabilities, huh?
Yes.
So we know it's, I mean, we're just talking amongst people who have limited capabilities.
Right.
And we're all wrong, probably.
Right. And that's actually one reason that the way that I look at this is sort of, it has what I call slack. Okay. Well, first of all, the interesting thing about every time I present this is nobody ever says, oh, I don't think your job description is right, which is exactly what I would love for someone just to take me on about. I don't think the Bible says that or whatever, but apparently everybody who's read it, well, a lot of the people who read it are atheists and haven't read a lot of the Bible. But those it never seems to be that the problem is with the content. So, but I still think, like you, that maybe the content's not right. And it turns out that that's how most theories are, if you think about scientific theories, for example. So think about, like, Newton's theory about how gravity worked. He was kind of right, at least for objects that are close to the surface of the Earth, right? If you go too far out, he's not going to be right. So he was right within a limited sphere. Einstein was able to generalize it to get it right within a much larger sphere. But you still think that he's talking about gravity, right? Nobody says Newton was so off that he wasn't even talking about gravity. Well, do they?
Someone probably did.
Maybe somebody does, but I guess I take it that what people say is something more like Einstein corrected Newton about gravity, but nobody says they're not even talking about the same thing. And so I think we are comfortable in other contexts with saying that we're fallible, that a theory doesn't have to be 100% right in order to pick out the object in question. And so also, I want to say, I don't have to be 100% right about every single thing on here. The being that I want to talk about just has to do kind of a lot of the stuff on here, at least some central subset of the stuff on here, in order to be God. I don't have to get every sort of cross every I and dot every T, but I've got to get an I in there or a T in there or something. You know, I have to have something so that it's recognizable, so that it's the same concept I need to talk about. I could be wrong, but the basics have to be there. Do you think we're more fallible than that?
Oh, yes.
And why do you think that?
Just we're so limited.
Well,
in knowledge.
If she's basing this philosophy off of the text, however, that she's looked at, you know, are the people who wrote these texts not weren't they just as fallible as we are? I mean, and so if she's looking at this, then the entire thing is up to that notion of being fallible. But but the fact that she's basing it off these texts, you have to look at the argument off of these texts.
Starting with that as a basis.
Yeah, starting with that as a given.
Yeah. I guess there's two points of problem, right? Either the texts themselves could be off base, which is a possible problem. And then the second problem is, maybe I didn't, you know, this is clearly a reduction of the number of kinds of things that is talked about in the text, and maybe I picked out non-salient ones, or I can tell you they're representative, and if you want to know chapter and verse where I got this stuff, I can do that, but, so they're there. But are they the ones that make you go, oh yeah, that's who God is? So that's another point of possible fallibility. So, I agree, it's fallible. There is an interesting possibility, too, I should just mention it, we should move on, but, whether we are getting the facts right about God or not, I think this still represents the use of the term God. So in the same way that you know, maybe what's a good example? Well, so Paul and I are talking about water. Think about people who are thinking about water in like 1500s before anybody knew much about chemistry. Is that accurate, Don? I don't want to be mean to the people who are looking. That's okay, so before they knew it was H2O. So the way they might have talked about water, because they don't really know what it truly is, right? In the same way that I think we don't really know what God truly is. The way they talked about it was sort of how it affected them. So by water, I mean the stuff that sparkles in the streams and falls from the sky that I can drink. That's what I mean by the word water. I'm not telling you what it is. I'm just trying to tell you what it is I'm trying to talk about. And that's what I take this view to be doing. My understanding of who God is these relations to me, the being who causes numinous experience in some people, who causes the existence of the universe, who has either issued forth or at least affirmed some rules of conduct, like the Ten Commandments, who has cared about the world and continues to care about it and the creatures within it, who wrote the scriptures some way or inspired people to write the scriptures in some way. So, you know, like H2O, I can't really tell you the stuff of God, but the way I want to talk about God is this, how it affects me.
Well, it's making me think of seeing through a glass darkly, much of Paul. So, I mean, that's the degree of fallibility that some of us might. We don't know what we are accepting as that darkness, just how much we're cloaked from.
Right. But so what I'm trying to say, though, is are you guys saying that we don't even know that we have religious experience? Or that we don't know that God created the universe?
No, we're just, I think, how much are we going to be imagining? And when are we going to realize that our imagination is still falling far short of what is still to be experienced?
Okay, so wait, is the idea that this is going to be like a starter list of relations?
Right.
So it's true that, say, you know, at least we believe Abraham was guided out of Ur by God. Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of religious experience for Abraham, moved to Haran. But that's not going to sum up all the kinds of religious experiences or even other kinds of experiences some people might have with God which aren't reflected here in the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's great. I mean, if it turns out that this is just kind of a historical starter list of stuff that we've experienced without God, and later on we want to say, hey, not only does it sparkle and, you know, stuff like that, but I can also swim in it. I learned how to swim, and that's something new I can do with water. And then we find out I can do something new with God that I've never done. Like, say, in heaven, I suspect that if there is a heaven, that kind of thing might happen. Mm-hmm. That would mean we would need to add a new relation, which you guys I called jobs, and this is part of why they didn't like me. Because I don't mean that to be heretical at all. I just find it to be a way that I understand what I'm talking about. To think of this as a job description that God wrote for himself and lives out for us. And so, again, no offense intended, it's just a shorthand way for me to think about what I'm doing here. But
Janine?
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to the text a little bit. After having spent 5.5 years in Utah, I got a little acquainted with some of the texts that people there use. And
Mormons.
The Mormons, yeah. Right, believe as strongly in their texts as what I would call regular Christians believe in the Bible. And some of the doctrines from those texts are contradictory to some of the doctrines from the traditional Christian texts.
Right.
And although I was looking through your list here, I don't see anything that contradicts these. But, for example, one of the things about their God is that he lives on a planet by the name of Golub, G-O-L-O-B. And we are not his spiritual children, but his physical children. And those are a couple of differences.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, though, if you can base this on a selection of texts, and other people believe in that text just as strongly, how can you exclude that text?
Great question. Okay.
I happen not to believe in that text, but
right,
if
right.
It's a matter of belief, and there are millions of people in the world who believe in that, then how can right. We discount it?
I actually take this to be a benefit in my view. But we'll see what you think by the end of this reply. So, you know how people talk about God in general? I actually am not sure that makes any sense. Because there are so many different theories about God. And so, it seems to me like, I understand what it means when someone wants to talk about the Judeo-Christian God, or when they want to talk about the Muslim God or the Mormon God, because there's maybe a different set of texts which you might look at as the theory to create a chart like this or to create a set of relations for that God. So So in a way, I take this to be sort of a template or an example of how anybody who's committed to a certain set of texts could understand the notion of God inherent in them.
So for each canon, you could have a different set of relations.
Yes, exactly.
That are valid for those adherents.
Yes.
Okay.
Because what I take it that I'm doing here is explaining the God of the adherents to these particular texts. So the Judeo-Christian God. I don't take myself to be saying this is who God is, although I probably talk like that. Use that shorthand. But really, carefully speaking, I mean to talk about the Judeo-Christian God. Mm-hmm. And I chose that God because I actually wanted to work in Islam, and my advisor said, holy cow, don't do that, that's too many texts. Which he was, I think, totally right. And I also think it would be interesting to examine them separately. But the idea is, I'm not sure I understand who God in general is, because I think that notion should be grounded in a set of texts, or some other sort of authoritative source. I'm not saying that all religions have texts as the authoritative source, but whatever they take to be authoritative would be the source you would use to try to read the notion of God off of. Then the $64 million question is, I say, when I'm 65, maybe I've done this for a few different religions or something. Mm-hmm. How much do the jobs overlap? Mm-hmm. If they overlap enough, maybe everybody is, strictly speaking, talking about the same God, which you hear people say a lot, right? People say that claim, mm-hmm. Well, the Muslim God is the same as the Christian God, is the same as the Jewish God, is the same as Brahmin and Hindu religion. I've always wondered, well, really, how do you know that? And that sounds nice and would politically be handy, but I'm not, I haven't done enough work to, at least on the way that I think one should, or at least on the way that makes sense to me, to understand who God is. I don't know if that statement is true, strictly speaking.
Question.
I think Paul has a follow-up question.
Just briefly, it seems that if you do that, and you have, and you find your areas of overlap, that's all well and good, but that's just sort of applying set theory to theology. That's saying, well, okay, here's, if we all took a vote, these are the characteristics we agree on, therefore that's God. And that seems like, that method seems better suited to Madison Avenue than to a theological inquiry.
Well, how about therefore that's the concept of God? Does that sit better? Okay. Therefore that's how we think about God.
Okay.
That's what we mean by the word God. Yeah. That's what we mean by the word God.
It's how we think of God. You know, that's all the word means. Mm-hmm. In any sense. Any word.
But this gets to the fallibility issue. Yeah.
Do you believe, because I'm Lutheran, that we all have the same perception of God? I think we all have different, perceive God in a different way.
In other words,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
What God is. God is God to me.
Okay.
To me. Now, what God is to this gentleman might be altogether different.
Right.
But he's still Lutheran. I'm not saying you are.
That's okay, I'm Lutheran.
But does this really matter? Or does this thing make it so complicated that the average person can't understand it? I think God spoke to this, to simple human beings, and most of the time it wasn't the people, the hierarchy. He spoke to the people close to the earth, I mean, simple people. And he tried to, well, God didn't, Jesus did. Mm-hmm. But I think he wanted to keep this simple so no matter who it was could understand mm-hmm. or have a feeling for it.
Right. That's certainly a benefit of perfect being theology. You want to know who God is? God's perfect. The perfect being, right? I mean, that's... But I guess I am not, well, I also don't think it might be super complicated, although it looks like it doesn't, but I'm not so sure that truth is generally simple. There's a famous philosopher who said, sorry I couldn't make it easier, but it's not my fault, that's just how reality is. And when I wrote this chart down, I kind of wrote that in the dissertation and said, look, some people might say this is too simple, because I've left out some pretty important relations, say sustaining the universe, I'm not talking about that. I can't even remember all the ones I left out, but I have a whole page full of stuff that I just dropped, okay? So I made it simpler than I think the texts make it out to be. But it is pretty complicated, but I actually think God is...
I'm finding it very complicated because I'm having a hard time following all this.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm just a simple person who, I'm not a highly educated person.
But that's okay. But
I know,
just
I feel it's all right, but I'm saying is that if we're going to make this thing so complicated, the average person or not highly educated person is going to say, wait a minute, this is blowing my mind. I don't know who God is anymore.
Mm-hmm. Here's a short way of saying it, just to say it short. God is the person who created the world, meets people in religious experience, cares about us, is worthy of our worship, awe, and trust. Okay? And the way that this chart is... I was interested in finding sort of general patterns amongst these things that I found that all these texts constantly repeated that God did. Because I understand things better when I generalize. Because I have trouble remembering the myriad of things. So what are the main things God does? He does this providential kind of stuff. He does this moral kind of stuff. He does this creative stuff. He does this, I even have to look right now. He does this personal stuff where he relates to us. He does the stuff that's sort of beyond and going to blow our minds, the transcendental stuff. And there's a lot of things under each of those kind of generalizations which I can point to. But I guess I don't think this stuff is for everybody, and I don't think actually thinking about the details of who God is for everybody, but for some people it's a burning question like it was for me. And for those people I think it's important to talk about it. But that doesn't mean everybody has to care. If you care and you want to talk about it, here's how I think about it. And another thing, the reason that I think it's important, and this is something we're going to do on day 5 in great detail, but just to give you a couple of, because I do think, you know, who cares, okay? I teach college, everyone says that all the time. People in the back row sit back and they go, just try to make interest. So it's not uncommon, okay? So my grandma and grandpa disagreed about who God was in this important way that affected their lives dramatically. My grandma thought that God, you know, you come across a problem and God will provide. My grandpa thought, you come across a problem and God gave you a good mind and a couple of hands and you better go do something about it, okay? Now, so grandma's sitting in the kitchen and kind of just waiting for something to happen, and grandpa's out on the farm doing something about it. And that all stems from their picture of God. They respond to their world and they do things differently because of how they see God. So, and that's just one example. And I mentioned last time I had my advisor for this entire project didn't believe in God, didn't even start relating to God because he thought it was impossible to be perfect because he saw logical problems between all these onlys and ends. So he just decided the whole thing was just crazy. And like I said then, you know, I think there are good reasons maybe to wonder about God's existence, but that just isn't one of them. And I had to figure out why. And so those are just two instances where I think, you know, where the rubber meets the road, the way you think about God affects your life. And better to do it carefully if you care to do it. But that's just...
Okay.
I'll go on. Yeah, and then...
I don't know if one of your authorities is Joseph Campbell, but...
I like him, but he's not one of the text authorities.
But he was talking to Bill Moyers in his last interview before he died, and he was... talking about all the religions, all the gods, and he didn't want to argue that it's all the same God, but different approaches maybe to the same God. But his recommendation was whatever your religion is, you should stick to it if it's Ojibwe, if it's Hindu, mm-hmm. and immerse yourself in that approach to that God. And it might be the same God.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was good attitude.
I think that's a really...
Now, then you don't have to struggle with all this. Is it Ojibwe God, Luther's God?
The Mormon God or whatever.
Yeah.
I go a long way towards that, although I think maybe that's a good reason to call me a heretic. I don't know. For those in the room who are more traditional. I guess I've also traveled enough and sort of had certain kinds of experiences religiously, but you always wonder, is this lunch or is this something real? that have maybe want to put the brakes on that at certain points, that there are some religions that scare me and I think might actually damage one's spirit. I don't want to name names. I don't know. There is one name I can name, but I guess I don't really want to do that because I think everybody needs to search that out. But
Methodism?
So
now look here.
So,
Can you distinguish between or with this kind of a philosophical examination and worship? Can they be separate experiences so that, because I think they are.
Worship and philosophical examination.
Yes, can you worship without
doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Can you do some of this and then put it on hold? I'm going to worship now. It enriches your worship, but it's not necessarily has to be completed. You don't have to have that philosophical examination complete done before you go worship.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, I worshiped in the process of writing my dissertation.
Uh-huh.
I think that there are many paths to God. And for some people, one of those paths is, I think possibly for me, philosophical thought. But for other people, that's just not going to be their way. I mean, that just doesn't make them feel closer to God or doesn't help them spiritually. And I've often envied people who didn't have to think about this. Because, at least sometimes I love it, and other times it just is a headache. I know so many people who do a far better job of worshiping than I do without having thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
And in some senses, I think those are the people who do what Jesus said, to have the faith of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often sort of wondered about why I'm not that way and whether that is a problem. But that's all.
Yeah.
Another conversation.
Yeah.
So. Let's go to you and Mike, and I think we may have to try to move on so we get more. I'm sorry.
I want to throw out a hypothesis to test this classification. If I believed in the perfect being God, perfect being theology.
Are you on page one?
Pardon?
You're on the front page here?
On the front page.
Okay, yeah.
To test the practicality of this. And I was a victim of 9/11, would I be angry at the God? Whereas if I were believed in relational theology, would I not be angry at God?
Good. This is a question about how do these views deal with the problem of suffering?
Or why does it make a difference?
How
bad things happen to good people.
Right. And why might that be the case if God's perfect? And why might that be the case if God is relational? When I've presented this to philosophers, the first thing they say is, hey, this is going to make the problem of suffering so much easier, because the problem arises for the perfect being theologian in a classic formulation that all philosophers of religion are familiar with, which is, if God is omnipotent, he can solve any problem that comes his way. If God is omniscient, God knows about all those problems, right? If God is omnibenevolent, God should want to solve every single one. He can, he knows about it, and he wants to, so why isn't he? Right? That's the problem of suffering for a perfect being theologian. Now, I don't know that, here's the problem for a relational theologian. If God can create the entire universe, these beautiful mountains all around us, Jupiter, the whole nine yards, looks pretty powerful. Could he stop some of the problems that we see around us? If God knows enough to judge us fairly in the moral job at the end of time, knows our secret inmost thoughts, probably seems like God knows some other things, and to create a universe that's complicated, you have to know an awful lot as well. And if God is nice enough to sit here and care for the world in the way we think God is supposed to in a providential job, and to give us the kinds of warm feelings that we get in religious experience that make us really feel loved in the most deep way that we possibly could, it looks like God really cares. So why is there suffering? So in other words, I don't think my view gets you out of the problem of suffering. I think I still have a lot of explaining to do. But I don't think any notion of God could probably get you out of that problem, because if it could, you probably have a pretty mean God on your hands. Right? But a mean being, like, maybe that's too strong for other religions, but in the Judeo-Christian tradition, I think suffering has got to be a puzzle, because the notion of God that's implicit in these texts seems to me to be so nice, so powerful, and so knowledgeable that that's a puzzling thing. Having said that, I do think that I have a little more room for maneuver in reply than the perfect being theologian does in the following way. If you guys notice D down there, which we haven't really talked about, there's a sentence that says, under the job description, the interesting surprise is that one is able to do all these jobs without being perfect. And again, I'm using perfect in the sense that without having the omnis and to me that was kind of a surprising finding in the course of doing my dissertation. Was also a handy result because I had something to say. Here's the idea there that if you look at, say take the axis of power for a second, just the property of power, and then take a look at all the jobs there. The idea is that the being that I'm thinking of has to have enough power to do everything that we see there. So it has to have enough power to inspire these deep mystical experiences, has to have enough power to create the universe, has to have enough power to care for us, to break the laws of nature when necessary, to do that in miracles, etc. And then think of that again for each property, has to have enough knowledge to do that stuff, has to have enough love. And the idea is that in the case of, take the case of power, you don't have to have total power to do this stuff on this list. You just have to be able to do this stuff on this list. So you don't have to be able to create 16 universes. You just have to be able to create this one. But if you're omnipotent, you would have to be able to create 16 universes. Because if you're omnipotent, you can do anything. Anything I can think of that's possible, you can do. That's what omnipotence means. So the idea is, the God that I'm thinking of only has to have this much power. It's true, could have more, but doesn't necessarily have to have more. Only has to have this much knowledge, but could have more. Now, you can take advantage of this sort of could have more phrase when you meet a problem like the problem of suffering. Because you can say, maybe it turns out God can't, or doesn't have more power than the stuff that we've seen happen in say, the text of the tradition. So maybe it turns out that when Jesus used clay to smooth the eyes of the blind man to help him to see, that somehow Jesus couldn't have done that without the clay or without the faith of the blind man. Now, an omnipotent God, you can't say stuff like that, right? But this God that I'm talking about, because what we're kind of doing is looking at the appearances of God's power in the text, you can kind of say, well, maybe that's it. Now, so maybe there are occasions where, say, there's something bad that's happening, like the blind man, where there isn't enough faith on the part of the people, the person in that, the object of the problem, or the people around that person, to sort of help God along in making the healing happen. Okay, this is pretty radical, but this is the way that I've been thinking about the problem of suffering since working on this, and this is actually one of the, I think, for me, has been personally one of the helps by thinking of God this way, because when I encounter a problem that I'm having trouble solving and that when I pray about, I still can't solve. Instead of just saying, I don't get it. You're supposed to have total power and total knowledge and total love. Where in the heck are you? I say, what is it that, you know, is there a problem with my faith? Or is it that I'm not talking to people of faith around me who are maybe your hands and the way that you need to work in the world? You need their help to work in this world. And maybe that's why I'm hurting right now. Maybe that's why 9/11 happened. And that kind of reply just isn't going to be open to the perfect being theologian. So, you know, that's one way, that's one sort of reply that I can gin up inside of myself with this kind of view that I couldn't with that other kind of view. Does that answer the question? What do you guys think of that? You're looking at me like that was way too complicated.
I went right over my head. I like the partnership.
Yeah. The co-creating.
Is that why you call it relational philosophy or
relational theology?
Sorry.
Because
of the human relationship involved.
Well, good question. It actually started out being called functional theology because it was sort of like you think of God by the function that God undertakes in the world. Kind of in a way you might think of a carburetor.
Yeah.
Like, you understand what a carburetor is, the thing that mixes air and gas and then sends
and
it out for ignition.
What it does. That's it.
And so originally that's how I said, well, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say, I'm understanding who God is, not by sort of the stuff that, you know, a carburetor can be made of metal, or it can be made of fans whooshing air around a pool or something like that, right? There's a lot of different ways to kind of realize the function of the carburetor.
You're just looking
and at it. I'm not trying to talk about those different ways of realizing it, which I think perfect being theologians are. I'm rather trying to just talk, identify God by the function of mixing air and gas, but the divine analog, which I take to be in that box, okay? And so, so I was calling it functional theology, but there's a few subtle philosophical problems with that term. So my advisor said, why don't you call it relational theology? And I thought that was kind of good because another way of understanding these functions is just philosophically there's a term relations, which means that there's a, we don't really need to know all that probably tonight. But so there's an ontological category called a relation, which exists. So good question. But yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about the fact that the co-creating kind of practical output of this view is relational. That what happens in this world is a result of our relating to God in certain ways, and that we truly are partners with God. There's a wonderful passage where Jesus says, I haven't called you slaves, I've called you friends. And I guess I find that really inspiring, and I understand what that means better here.
Okay.
Mike.
I just want to say that I think what you're doing is very important because you're so right that how we think about God affects our everyday life. Even if this seems complicated, which it can be, I mean, it's very, very practical. If we think of God as some being way, way far away and sort of created the world and then took off, I mean, that could be part of a Lutheran or a Methodist view, potentially. And that's going to be a very different sense of God and will affect how we relate to lots of different people and places. I mean, or if we think of God as both present and imminent and transcendent, that will affect how we live every day, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It gets related to how we treat the natural world, if we think God is present here or not. So, or if we think God is some judge in the sky only, and not as a lover and nurturer, it's going to affect how we want to relate to God and everyone else. So the implications of this are very profound for everyday living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, on day 5, we're going to be focusing on that with a little help from some psychology of religion. Some actual studies of how your notion of God impacts you and your life, and actually how you relate to other people too. Yeah.
Just a quick, I don't know, Mike, if this is a good example of what you're saying, but I think 9/11 illustrates that in that I think, this can never be known, but I believe the hijackers may have felt that they were doing God's work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how they viewed God very much affected how a lot of people's lives ended up.
That's a really strong example. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so that's relational theology. And the difference between an imperfect being theology. I should just say this little second column about, if you get back to the first page where it says relational theology, God is the being, if any, who does most of the stuff on the back page. The characteristics it takes to do that it's a lot more flexible, or another way of saying it is we know a lot less about who God is on this view than if we accept the other view. I actually take that to be a plus, because I think, I guess, the fallibility stuff. I think we probably don't know a whole lot about who God is intrinsically. So think about the carburetor again for a second. What it is to be a carburetor in column one is to be something that mixes air and gas and sends it out for ignition. Column two, what it takes to do that is maybe to have steel, to have a receptacle made of something strong enough to hold the air and the gas in there, and then have some kind of fan to send it out for ignition. Okay, that would be one way of realizing the carburetor. There's a multitude of ways you could make it out of some other material. You could make it with something other than a fan. You could sit there and just go. Okay, so there's a bunch of ways to realize that function. Similarly, I want to say there's a bunch of different ways you could realize the functions here. One of those ways is to have the omnis and the ims. You would just be sort of underachieving, I think, if I'm right, about the fact that you don't really need the omnis and the ims to do this stuff. If you had the omnis and ims and you were doing these jobs, you probably could have done more, but you just didn't, because they are more than it takes to do these jobs. But that would be one way of doing them. But another way would be to say, be slightly less powerful than omnipotent, but have everything else. So you'd be totally knowledgeable, and you'd be totally, loving. Okay. Another way would be maybe keep omnipotence the way it is, but drop a little omniscience, that kind of thing. So there's just, I think, an infinite number of ways those jobs could get done. I'm not saying just anybody can do them, though, and this is a point that Anne raised yesterday. She was looking at our list over here, and she said, well, people can do that stuff, right? I don't think we could do the jobs as listed here. I think it was accurate yesterday, because we didn't have the sort of list that we have here today. But, because we can't really go ahead and create the existence of the universe, and we can't, we're not worthy of worship. We're not worthy of the kind of prayers that people give to God. So you got to have quite a bit. You have to have pretty massive amounts of power and knowledge, but you don't have to have total power and knowledge to do that. So there's just a bunch of different ways that you could do these jobs. And that's interesting to me, because I guess I think it stays quiet about God's sort of intrinsic nature, about who God really is, but still allows us to talk carefully about God by talking about how we relate to God. You guys are looking kind of sleepy. let me just kind of whiz through. Are there questions?
Maybe this goes back to asking what perfectionism is. But do you think that our infallibility prevents us from understanding what complete perfection is? And so that's why we're not really the creation. Relational philosophy agrees with us more because we're so far removed from perfection that we can't understand it, so we just use metaphors trying to grasp what omnipotence. And we need to define where omnipotence creates friction, because I can't put my brain around what that actually means. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's right, that it's hard to define those omnis and ims and to understand what perfection is. But so you're saying that fact that we kind of balk at perfection might make us like relational theology.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought of it that way. I guess that would be, I mean, I think that that's true for me. And I don't know, does that sound true for you? That one of the things you like about...
Could you repeat what you said?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Nice.
You want to just say it louder? Do you want me to repeat it?
Yeah.
Okay. So she said, perfection is a pretty tough concept, and so tough that we don't really know what it means. And we don't even really know when we try to elucidate it in terms of the omnis and ends, what those mean. And so that might make us like relational theology, because we might have a better idea of what we mean when we say God created the world, or God meets us in religious experience. In other words, maybe perfect being theology is pretty abstract, and relational theology is pretty concrete. And that might be a plus for relational theology, given our minds. Is that sound right? Mm-hmm. It's probably true. That would be nice if that were true for my view. And I think it might be.
I've used up my presence here, but but it seems to me that in an hour of worship in a Lutheran, Episcopal, Catholic liturgy, we do all these things, or all these things are done to us in some way or another. We could, in the creed, we talk about, well, we talk about all these things, and in the sermon, probably we're talking about you naughty people, and in the music we're having a transcendental experience. And so I was thinking philosophy of worship aren't incompatible. I mean, it's all, this is what happens at worship.
Insofar as that's right, I succeeded in getting a pretty good job description on paper. Because the idea is there's not supposed to be any surprises here. You're supposed to kind of look at it and go, yeah, so I think that God does that stuff. If that's right, then this is a good way of talking about the relations that ground our relation to God. So that sounds good to me.
Janine?
Yeah.
Dale up here.
Oh, hey.
The issue that it raises for me is, at what point do I decide God is wrong and say I know better than God knows?
If God is sort of less
than perfect. If God is imperfect and is wrong at times, how do I decide, God is wrong this time, I'm right, I know better. At what point do I say, not my will, God's will?
Right. Not God's will, my will. Right? Is that what you just...
No, not my will, but God's will. At what point do I finally say that?
Hopefully always,
even with an imperfect God.
Yeah. I mean, just because God's imperfect doesn't mean God is not somebody you really respect or more perfect than us, right?
You can't say it's wrong just because it's imperfect.
Pardon?
You can't say it's wrong. It's wrong just because it's imperfect.
Right. And this actually, Dale, kind of gets to the stuff on the normative relations. Normative just meaning sort of worthy of, or usually kind of talks about shoulds in the moral realm. But actually, I'm not sure that's the right word here, now that I think about it. But the idea here is sort of that God's not only supposed to cause certain things, but that God is supposed to be worthy of the kinds of attitudes that we have toward God. According to, if you're reading who God is off of the text of the tradition in the way that I'm suggesting, then the idea is, if the text suggests that God's will is something that you should follow, which I think it does, then the God that I mean to talk about is the God who is worth that kind of following. That's sort of what's implied by the service part under the moral task. That God is supposed to be the actual object of service and also the proper object. It's supposed to make sense. The God that I mean to talk about is supposed to make sense to go, your will is something that I believe in so strongly that I'm willing to devote my life to it. What do you think?
Well, I believe that God is imperfect, but then I can't know his imperfection.
Can't know what's imperfect about God?
Yeah.
That's, in a sense, true, because there's so much on the loose in the nature of God in question, as explained in the second column of the relational theology on the first page, right? The idea is, I can't really tell you whether God's perfect or whether God's imperfect in some way, less than perfect. And again, notice perfect has this really careful meaning. But I can say maybe with, I guess, here's where the pressure comes when you run into something like the problem of suffering, where you say, here's what I do anyway now. I wonder, can God handle this situation alone? Which I think in a sense means, I'm wondering whether God has the power to do it. I'm wondering whether God's imperfect in that way, whether the way that God realizes the jobs has less than omnipotence.
Yeah.
And that we come in the situation. But I'm only guessing, right? I don't really know. And it's sort of one of those questions I would ask God when I get there, sort of like, remember that day I was praying to you in the field and I was really frustrated and nothing seemed to be happening? Why did that happen? Like, is it that you couldn't help me that day? Or was something else happening you didn't know? Or, see what I mean? Like, so there's a sense in which we have to guess at what the imperfections are, given the experience we have of God. That we're licensed to think that maybe there is some imperfection. Because all we really know about God is that God can do this stuff. There's other stuff that we've seen. But that doesn't tell us a lot about what the imperfections might be.
So there's really three choices. One is we pick a perfect God, or we pick an imperfect God, or we say we finally don't know, and we merely see God as worthy of our worship.
There's a fourth choice.
Okay.
That's this freedom business. We don't have to make any of those other choices.
Freedom meaning freedom not to make a choice?
Yes. And that would make God even more perfect because he gave us that gift.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's probably not going to affect God if we don't make a choice.
That
but
affects
I guess,
our perception of God, though, which is what God is what we're talking about anyway.
Okay, how did you feel the day that you didn't get your job?
Not so good.
Did you say, God, how come I didn't get that job? And now how do you feel about it now?
So wait, I feel okay now, but I was unhappy that day.
And you thought, God, how come I didn't get that job?
Oh, right, so you're suggesting the problem of suffering can be resolved.
Sometimes you don't know God's path that he wants
right.
to take.
Right,
yeah.
He answers, but we aren't. We it's not the answer we want.
We think we got the answer, but we don't.
That we think we should have.
Right. I think this is back to fallibility. We're limited.
But is there not
this
no suffering?
We weren't promised no suffering either.
This is a whole different discussion. Like, I can't really solve the problem of suffering up here and still talk about the nature of God. But we could talk about this. I'd love to talk about this after class. Maybe you guys is this a class? she's been eager, and then we'll get to you. And then we have to go.
Two stories about Abraham that either speak about Abraham or speak about God and faith are the story of bargaining about the people in Gomorrah, which gives that idea that God is going to change his mind. Okay, that's a real relational thing. Then the other story is following the will of God to sacrifice his son. And the two existed in the same person with the same God. And they are really, I think, why we get thrown off. But it's wonderful relations both ways.
That is, actually, I meant to read some of these books, but there is a lot of complicated tension in the character of God and in our relations to God. And I think that's what makes God interesting enough to think about and to live with for your life.
Yeah.
In the same way that you're not always that psyched to be with a person who's kind of just, oh, interesting, or who's very, very predictable. I think that the God of the Bible is surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I came to appreciate that more when I read this book by Jack Miles called God, a Biography. How many people have heard this or read this? What he does, he used to be a Jesuit, and then he worked for a while for the New York Times and some other went and got a PhD in Near Eastern language at Harvard, and he's just a wonderful writer. And what he does is explore the God of the Old Testament and try to show you, as if you were reading it the first time, the development of the character of God. And what he finds is that there's tons of tensions of the kind that you just pointed out with that example. That God is this really complicated being who makes you go, wait, I thought you were going to do this, but you didn't. You did something different. And I guess I think that on relational theology, that's pretty congenial to my view, because on this other theology, you know, there's adjectives like immutability never changes. That one, an impassibility, is not affected by anything. When you read the Old Testament, it's pretty hard. I mean, there are strange philosophical interpretations of how it is that God could be immutable and impassible and still talk to Abraham in that way and seem to respond. And it all comes down to that it's just seeming to respond as it actually responded. But I think it's much more interesting, personally, to read it as it seems to be written, which is that God does actually respond and is affected by people, and so does change, and so is not immutable, and so is affected by us, and so is not impassable. So I guess that's a segue to next time, because I think it's more biblical to read God as a relational theologian and as a perfect being theologian. It's not more true to the rest of the tradition later, though. So there's a tension there. You might have to figure out which part you believe more in. I promised yes.
My own personal thought, though, is that God has acted for relieving suffering through sending his Son. And if we would follow those precepts of Jesus, he was teaching us how to relieve suffering. And if we would be, you know, we're supposed to become more Christ-like.
Yes.
And if we did, it would be, the suffering would be relieved. So I don't see it as God's failure. I see it as our failure. And I see it as a perfect God who has shown us the way, mm-hmm. and we have not followed through.
Mm-hmm. But here's just a little bit of a challenge to that. A perfect God wouldn't need us to follow through. If we were falling down on the job, that God could step in. Right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there's some reason that God's not stepping in.
Yes.
And that's hard to explain mm-hmm. on that view. Mm-hmm. But on my view, the idea is a perfect God does, or the relational God might, Dale, might need us to step in. I'm just guessing. But maybe that's why things aren't working out. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think you're exactly right that if we were Christ-like and we stepped in the way Christ would step in, then the problems would at least be alleviated. I don't know if I could say they'd be totally gone, but if everybody did, maybe they would be.
That's right.
We always fall short, though. We're sinful people, so
right.
We never meet that ultimate goal.
Well, then, I'm just going to bring back the suffering, so there's no place. So.
Okay, well, so we have to go because we're already 5 minutes late. But just to say, next time we'll just kind of work on some of the history of perfect being theology, which I think is interesting. And for me, what the function of that is that it frees me to think, well, heck, maybe it's not sacred and I can actually think of God in a different way without dodging my true commitments. And then the second thing I'll talk about is some of the biblical support and other pros and cons for the two views. So thanks for coming.